You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
I am really excited to talk about such an important topic again today. We're starting off 2022 with just really big topics. So I'm really excited to do this episode with Sarah Winter. If you haven't read this article that she wrote for Vanity Fair, it's really eye-opening and really incredible and really informative, especially for a first-time mom who had a baby during the pandemic. And I'm really excited that she's going to come on here and talk to us. We're going to get right to talking about postpartum depression and her experience with postpartum psychosis, which I didn't even know about. Hi, Sarah.
Oh, it worked. Hi.
How are you? I'm great. How are you?
Oh my gosh, you can hear me. You can see me.
I know. I was just saying that your Vanity Fair piece that I was sent by many different people, but also talked about with my mom and then reached out to you to do this conversation because it was so eye-opening for me because I hadn't even heard of postpartum psychosis. And your story was also really, I mean, incredible. And of course, I want to talk about it, but also not traditional, I think the kind of typical things that we think about when we think about postpartum depression wasn't really what you experienced. So I wanted to talk about it because there are so many women, you know, that especially have had babies during this pandemic time, and these rates of postpartum depression are at an all-time high. And so I wanted to kind of talk more about this experience and also just everything as a part of your journey. So, and of course the movie that came along with this, which is also incredible. But I want to go back to your journey because your first son, you did not have any postpartum depression.
No, I was completely euphoric. You know, I had the, you know, sleep deprivation right. moments and, you know, those things. And, you know, I would tear up occasionally, you know, just with the beauty of it all. You know, I tried really hard to have my children. I struggled with infertility and, did IVF and, you know, so I look at my kids as especially miraculous and, mm-hmm. And special to me, as kids are to every mom. But yeah, I had no reason to expect or, you know, worry about any kind of postpartum, you know, yeah. issue. And I also, my understanding of postpartum was not what I thought it was, you know, and I'm an educated person, but I didn't realize it can manifest itself in so many different ways. You know, you can get very depressed, you can become manic, and yeah, the worst kind is postpartum with psychosis, which was the one I got.
Right.
When my twins were born.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit in the article, just to give people an overview. You were wanting to get pregnant again after your first, and you went through a variety of different routes to try and get pregnant, finally got pregnant with twins, had the twins.
Yep. At 40 years old, it was a journey. I was incredibly excited and happy. And the pregnancy, you know, with twins, it's always a little, you know, they talk about the risks. And, you know, I was considered, you know, mature, like an old, you know, to have twins. And, you know, I certainly wasn't the oldest person to ever, you know, give birth at this New York hospital because, you know, women are waiting later and later and, you know, we have more choices now. But I was overjoyed. And I started to not sleep well, though, toward the end of my pregnancy. I got enormous. I had sciatic pain in my legs, so I couldn't sleep on my side. And, you know, you can't sleep on your back. You're not supposed to sleep on your back too much when you're pregnant. And you, obviously you can't sleep on your stomach. So I ended up buying a Lazy Boy off the internet because I thought I could just sleep sitting up. And so I started the process of like nearing their birth date, when they were born, very tired. And, you know, quite exhausted, which, you know, I had a incredible birth story with them. You know, I was scared of having a C-section, you know, some women don't understand that. They're like, you wanted to give birth to twins. That sounds horrific. And I was just so nervous about being cut open. I don't know. That's just me. I guess I'm attached to my abs and I was nervous about the amount of time, the recovery, you know, because I had a 3.5-year-old at home in Westchester, which is like almost an hour's drive, you know, where we were living at the time from New York City. So I got to push out these incredible little babies. And then, you know, I was made aware at the time that there would be a NICU stay, you know, maybe 12 hours, maybe 24 hours, could be a couple of weeks, could be up to 5 weeks. And, you know, the one thing about not having a C-section is they kick you out. They kick you out of the hospital after like a day and a half.
Right.
So I was commuting into the city to spend time with the babies. And, you know, my anxiety of being in a NICU. And this was pre-COVID. So, you know, the whole germ thing was very, it doesn't sound so shocking. It doesn't seem, you know, Cloroxing things and Purell and germs and, but I became very conscious of these tiny little babies that could be hurt by a germ. And I became, it became very taxing, you know, driving in, you know, I was pumping breast milk in the night and then the beeping of the, and every NICU parents will talk about the beeping noises at the hospital that I would hear when I got home. Like I would continue to hear the beeping and every beep, whether it was a phone or the microwave or the refrigerator or a car backing up or would sort of give me a huge amount of anxiety. And that's when things started to spiral a little bit.
Right. So you had a stay in the NICU and you talked about kind of like the PTSD that you had from your experience in the NICU with the beeping noises and just being in there. And then of course the germ aspect of it, which as somebody who gave birth during COVID, I really related to, that heavily just because, and of course it was pre-COVID and it was a different time, but you know, the paranoia about what, you know, comes in your home or what comes with a person and then touching a little tiny baby was definitely something that I was, you know, very frantic about.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
You kind of talk a little bit about when you got home, the kind of, which I want to talk about, like, you know, about what the things that happened were that you kind of look back on and say, like, these are first signs of postpartum depression or postpartum psychosis, because they aren't typical. I think that a lot of us think that postpartum depression is just feeling, you know, depressed or sad or also having negative thoughts towards your baby, but yours kind of express themselves in various different ways, which was, you know, of course, manic, but also frustration at your husband, frustration at friends, at certain things in your life and you know, getting to a point even with your husband where you wanted a divorce because you were so frustrated by his presence. So can you talk a little bit about and how quickly that happened after you returned home with the twins?
It was within 6 weeks. I got worse and worse and worse and more manic. And the better they were and the healthier they were, because when they're in the NICU, you worry about the breathing and the weight, gaining weight and, you know, yeah. Can they swallow on their own and can they take milk and can they nurse and blah, 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 blah. When that was off the table, I started then worrying about, well, you know, I would turn my attention to, well, what if there was a tree that was leaning up against or appeared to sort of lean a little toward my house. And I thought, I better have that tree looked at and I better move the furniture out of the basement because there might be a flood. And we were living several hundred feet above sea level on a big hill. But I started to worry about their safety. And when a friend of mine gently suggested I might be suffering or I might have a little, I was like, no. This is not postpartum depression. I love my babies and I don't want to hurt them, because right. I thought postpartum depression was the desire to hurt yourself or hurt your children. I said, no, right. I have the opposite. So I do not have postpartum depression. So you mm-hmm. can put that away. And she was like, okay. Let me help you clean your basement up and, you know, we'll get someone to look at that tree. And I was getting more and more paranoid as well and not sleeping at all. And the bar kept getting higher and higher in terms of what I needed to fix or organize. And, you know, I started to think, well, and when you start to lose your mind, you never think you're losing your mind. You think it's got to be something else. It's, you know, my husband at the time, you know, it was just like he thinks I'm crazy. You know, he keeps telling me, like, why are you so worried? Like, look at the babies. They're fine. Look at Oscar. The sun is shining. The flowers are blooming. Everything's great. Nothing's going to happen. Nothing's going to happen, Sarah. Nothing's... And I was just like, well, but anything could happen. Things happen all the time. Right. And it got to the point where I went from being concerned about germs to thinking every car was driven by a drunk driver. The UPS guy was in a stolen uniform and he was a serial killer. The tree was going to hit the house. The plane was going to crash into the house was going to catch on fire. And everywhere I looked, I was catastrophizing every single moment. Every piece of furniture had the potential to decapitate me or my babies. It was exhausting, the amount of worry and the amount of, and I thought, I'm the only person that's worried, because no one else seemed as worried as I was. So I had to be hypervigilant about protecting my family and their safety. And it was this one girlfriend of mine, Natalie, who said, you're right, Sarah. These things could happen. They likely won't statistically, but they could. And I exhaled for the first time in weeks. I thought, she understands me, you know, because she said they might happen. So I felt heard and seen. Mm-hmm. And, she gently suggested, you know, I might want to talk to someone, I might. And then they staged this intervention, which was shocking. And I was very angry, but also incredibly relieved, because I had been living in such a state of anxiety and worry and paranoia that it was not sustainable at all. And I was spending less and less time with my babies. With my children, you know, nursing twins is time consuming. And I was so exhausted, I would just hand them back and then focus on, you know, finding another place to live. At one point I said to my husband, we have to leave this town. Everyone's talking about me and it's too big and it's too busy. And he said, Sarah, we live in a village with 6,000 people. Like, you've lived in New York City and Los Angeles. Like, we couldn't live in a smaller town. And I was like, no, it's too busy. There's too many people and we have to leave. And I thought, there's nowhere safe. Where am I going to go? And I even got to the point, I became obsessed about raccoons, because I saw on the news one night that if you accidentally ingest raccoon feces, it can cause brain damage. And we had raccoons at the time attacking our garbage outside. So I started thinking, okay, someone's going to walk inside, stepping in some raccoon poop, and my younger son is going to pick something up off the floor that has some feces on it, put it in his mouth, kiss one of the babies, and we're all going to be brain damaged. So I became obsessed with raccoons and everyone taking their shoes off. And then I heard raccoons were attracted to the smell of chicken. So it was like, no more chicken in the house. And when you have a baby and people want to bring you a dish, everyone brings chicken because who doesn't like chicken?
Exactly.
And I was like, no more chicken, no more chicken. I'm sorry to any friends that are watching this and this is the first time hearing this. Your beautiful chicken dinners were, I had to have it out of the house, you know, and yeah. It doesn't make sense, you know, but to me it did. And to me, it was all I could do to try and control these situations because everything felt so chaotic.
For me, when I was reading your piece, I found that to be really interesting because these were all kind of different behaviors that I hadn't associated with postpartum depression, and so it was really interesting and eye-opening for me. And the parts that you had kind of woven in with your friends, you know, trying to gently say to you, I think that you might need help. I think that there are a lot of people who find themselves in that situation of how do you gently, you know, it can be postpartum depression or it can be in a totally different scenario, but how do you gently say that without someone saying, you know, no, I don't have that,
yeah,
you know, and get very defensive about it. But you ended up talking about waking up from a nap, having a very clear staged intervention happening for you with your two friends and also your baby nurse at the time.
And my aunt, which I had to edit a lot with the Vanity Fair, but my aunt was there as well at that time.
Yeah. So, and that, you know, led you to talking to somebody that explained to you that there are three different phases of, or three different kinds of postpartum depression. I also wasn't aware of, which is, you know, one being baby blues, which is kind of the most mild, then postpartum depression after that, and then postpartum psychosis, which you were diagnosed with and ended up going to a facility and checking into a facility for, I think you said 8 days.
It was 8 long days.
Eight days. And really having intense treatment in a psych ward to get through your postpartum psychosis.
Oh, I just got emotional for a minute. It was the first doctor, just so you know, the Vanity Fair article, I had to take it from 11,000 words because it started out as a thank you essay to my girlfriends, like a love letter to say thank you. I remember a lot and I'll never forget what you did. But it was so long, Vanity Fair were like, you got to take it down to like 2,000 words. So it was difficult, but there's a bunch missing. And one of the things that was missing was my girlfriends took me to, after the intervention, to a local psychiatrist in Westchester. And I spoke to her for an hour and I got it all out. And I looked at, I asked if they could come in the room with me because I was scared. And I didn't trust what I was going to say at that point. I didn't trust my memory. I didn't trust what I was seeing or hearing. I wanted to be accurate. And at the end of the hour, this lovely woman said, thank you so much for sharing this. I don't feel comfortable diagnosing you. I'm going to send you to someone in the city who is more equipped professionally to deal with this. And I looked at my friends and I was like, what? I just, no, I can't do this again. I can't go through this whole story again. And I broke down and I said, did she just tell me my issue is too big for Westchester, the county of Westchester, New York? I have to go to the city? And they were like, no, she's just saying that, you know, you might need someone, you know, who's more experienced. And anyway, so they did then find me this incredible psychiatrist in the city who recommended I go to a psychiatric hospital. And I was just like, no way, no. Because she said, you know, you will probably have to go on some antipsychotic drugs. You won't be able to nurse. And I just said, I'm so sorry. I think I'll do it at home. I'll do it. I'll figure it out on my own. I don't want to stop nursing. And And then, you know, ultimately I gave in and I said, I can handle this for 3 days. You know, I'm going to look at it as a spa. I'm going to, you know, the photos of this place, and it looked very sort of, you know, I can sleep. There was an emphasis of, you know, there's a chef. And I thought, I'm just going to, and they talked about checking in, and I was like, oh, it's like a hotel. All right, I'll just pump. I'll take my pump. I'll pump and dump. And after 3 days, I'll be out of there. And, you know, after 3 days, I wanted to go home, and they said, you can't, you know. And I said, well, I missed my baby so much. I missed Oscar. I was so sad, and it all felt so unfair that I had gotten this sick, that I needed to be there. And I said, I want to sign, I forget what it's called now. It's a thing that you request your 72 hours to be released. And they sat there and they talked to me and they said, we really think you need to be here longer. So it stretched into 8 days. And then when they said, you're going to have to be on these antipsychotic drugs for up to 6 months, I was like, I'm not going to pump and dump for 6 months. I just, you know, it's too hard. And, you know, I had to give up that dream, you know, mm-hmm. of giving them what I'd given my older son and not judging myself and recognizing that I had to have, you know, to be on these drugs. And, you know, I think, you know, I was just telling a friend the other night, I had this photographer come to the house when the babies came home. And I thought, if I could make my life look like a beautiful photo shoot. And I remember I had this beautiful white lace nightgown and they were dressed, you know, so soft and beautiful and naked. And I thought, if it looks a certain way, if it looks really beautiful and soft, like a commercial or a TV show, it'll feel that way. Mm-hmm. And this was kind of before Instagram became such a thing. And life is not like that. It doesn't matter how it looks. And recognizing that was really painful. It didn't matter how I made things look on the outside, or I tried to sort of pretend everything was great. And, you know, my friends and my family, they knew I wanted these babies so much. And I went through so much to have them. I wanted it to all look really beautiful and happy. And it wasn't. It was actually a disaster. And, but I wanted to go back to your, the friend thing, because my friends were so brave. A lot of people wouldn't butt in to a family situation and say, we think you need help. Mm-hmm. People won't want to risk a friendship or risk offending somebody by saying, we think you might be struggling, or we think you might have, you know, postpartum depression, or, you know. And I was like, no, I think I have PTSD. I have PTSD from the NICU. That's what I have. Because for some reason, we judge ourselves. You know, I'm still in this moment right now with you, Catherine, judging myself a little bit for even coming down with this illness, you know, mm-hmm. that why couldn't I have just sucked it up? You know, I had all the help in the world. I was considered, you know, if you look at me from the outside, very privileged. You know, I had I'm since divorced, but my husband had a great job. I had great health insurance. He had great health insurance. We had access to childcare, the best doctors. My family did live in Australia, so I was isolated from family. Mm-hmm. But I had all these incredible resources, and yet I was in a very dangerous, terrible, terrible place had it not been for my friends, you know, my girlfriends, and who got me the help that I needed.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's, first of all...
Sorry, I'm just rambling on and on, and I'm not even letting you talk. I'm so sorry.
No, it's great. I mean, this is exactly why I wanted to have this conversation. And I think, again, I said this before, it is so brave for you to be able to come on here and share your story. And, of course, to share your story in the writing format and also to be able to have conversations like this, because the whole goal is to share your story with the hopes that, you know, someone watching will be able to feel less alone in their journey and get the help that they need. And postpartum depression, postpartum life is a crazy trip anyway. And postpartum depression is totally out of your control, no matter how much help or privilege you might have. It's a very challenging time. And also your hormones are at play and it's a crazy thing that's totally out of your control. I think the biggest thing, I think, for people who are watching, and even people like myself who have friends who've given birth recently and will give birth recently, is what is the correct thing to say? I mean, your friends were very brave and bold, but a lot of the time, you know, as you said, friendships will, people will have a bad reaction to somebody saying something to them. And also partners. I mean, your husband, you wrote, your husband was on his knees begging you to get help and you refused. So I think for people who are watching, who are either, you know, partners to somebody who's going to give birth or has given birth and feels like they might be struggling with postpartum depression or anxiety, what is the, now that you're able to reflect on it, maybe the best way to go about gently suggesting so they can get the help that they need, but, you know, not upsetting somebody?
It's such a good question. And it's something I've been bashful about over the last 10 years too. If I wonder if someone's struggling, you know, you don't want to, you don't want to project either. I don't want to project my own experience onto someone, you know, just because I had a bad time of it. Doesn't mean the next person will. And I think for me, the biggest thing was just what's not helpful is when someone says, it's going to be fine. Just wait till spring. Wait till the baby's eating. Wait till, look at the sun shining. Like, look, you've got so much to be happy about. It's feeling seen and heard in the moment. And having people say, Sarah, I see you struggling and I see you're in a lot of pain. I won't abandon you and you won't go through this alone. And I feel women who don't have support and who don't have financial support, emotional support, family support, or they feel a sense of isolation. And it doesn't matter whether you're a princess in a castle or someone on welfare. Maternal mental health hits everyone, and everyone's entitled to be seen and heard and to get help and to not feel embarrassed to ask for help or accept help. And if you're not, it's very important not to feel shamed, you know, and to not feel, because when you're in it and you're in the muck and the messy ugliness of it, someone saying, it'll all get better. It doesn't, you don't hear that. What you do hear is someone saying, I see you and I hear you. Mm-hmm. And I will not let you go through this alone.
I think that's even
what happens when you talk about something traumatic. Someone said this recently. They're like, do you notice you do that? I'm like, yeah, I do. Do you do that? Like, yeah, that's what happens when you talk about something traumatic. It's like your brain sort of, you know, freezes. But
that's even just great advice in itself, is just to be able to say to somebody that you see that's struggling that you're going to be there for them and that you see that they're feeling.
The other thing is, don't say, what can I do? Just say, I'm going to do this for you. Don't say, how can I help? My friends were like, I'm coming over later and I'm going to unload the dishwasher for you. I think that would be good for you, Sarah, because I know you're funny about the dishwasher, you know, I'm going to come over later and I'm going to bring the boys, Oscar, a treat. And just so he, you know, because I know you're so busy and everyone wants to come over and hold babies, right? But not everyone wants to come over and empty your dishwasher or put a load of laundry on or take someone, you know, if you have another child that is feeling neglected, like take them for a walk or take them to the park or, you know, you know, I was comfortable enough to say, you know, this is crazy, right? What I'm going through is crazy. This sounds crazy. And even now I have to come up with another word. It doesn't help when someone says, you're acting crazy. That is crazy. That's crazy. That is, God, you're being such a bitch. Like, why are you acting like such a bitch? Sure I was being a nightmare. I was a nightmare. But it's not helpful to, you know, when you're having a doctor say, you know, this is a family emergency. What you're going through, Sarah, is something serious. You know, a friend of mine's husband at the time said, and this was amazing, and it really resonated with me. He said, Sarah, if you, regarding to taking these drugs, because I was so scared about staying on them and the depression was just awful. He said, if you had no legs and you needed to cross a highway to get to your children, you would put prosthetic legs on, right? So you could get across the highway. You know, in the same way, you need to take these drugs and stay on them until you're better, you know, so you can be a really, so you can be a good mom. And I'm still judging myself for it, but I'm getting better. And I'm the first person to say to someone, if you need help, take it, whether it's, you know, you need financial assistance, whether you need self-care, whether you need whatever that looks like, you know, whether I prioritize sleep now. And I felt very shameful about my sleep habits, you know, and taking a rest, you know, and taking a nap during the day. I can't believe I actually said that. I take a nap during the day sometimes because I really need to. Yeah. I have three sons.
What has helped you with the feelings that you're talking about where you feel shame towards your journey or your experience? Because I think obviously, you know, having people like yourself talk about these things, whether it's mental health or maternal mental health, is so important. And that helps, of course, take away some of the stigma. But it also, you know, you still do experience shame around the subject or talking around about it or reflecting on it. Is there anything that has helped you or resources that have helped you that might be able to help another mother or person just be able to deal with the shame and also let them know they're not alone, but also be able to give them tools for maybe the start of their journey that they feel like they might be having something similar to what you experienced?
The biggest, the most overwhelming thing for me regarding shame is the minute this Vanity Fair thing came out, it was like this weight had been, this 10-year weight had been lifted off my shoulders, that no one said, no one was turned off by it. No one said, oh my God, you know, that's just, you should be so embarrassed. The fact that people like yourself reached out to me and said, thank you for saying that. Thank you. And of course, you know, when I experience, when girlfriends open up about something they're struggling with or dealing with, it makes me feel less alone. And it makes me feel I can share something. And I think just, you know, a lot of women have reached out to me and said, I'm going to start writing down how I feel. Because writing down how you feel can be very therapeutic and very be very helpful. But the power of shame is so overwhelming. Like I would have written this and published it years ago had I known that this would have been the reaction. You know, I wound up executive producing this movie, and you know, the producer, when she read my story, she was like, "This is a movie," and I was like, I'm not going to share this. This is embarrassing. And I was also, you know, at that point I was divorced and I felt like I didn't have a happy ending. Like my story wasn't a happy one. And I thought, I'm not going to let down the postpartum community by, you know, saying, yes, I got through this and I powered through and I got better. And then my husband left me, you know, that to me was not triumphant. So I had to sort of get to a good place in my life where I felt strong enough and, okay mentally and you know and the movie helped me with that. That, you know, seeing Amanda Seyfried talk about her struggles and being on medication was just revelatory to me to you know, and see other actors and read about their stories and I'm like, they can do it, so I should be able to do this, you know. And it's just been incredible. It's been I don't know, I can't even describe how
I'm sure
what a weight, what a weight has been lifted just by being open and sharing and not being ashamed that, you know what, this happened and, you know, it didn't look great. And life does not look like it does on Instagram or Facebook. It's, life is messy. And sometimes it's really messy. And it's okay to talk about that. And it's okay to say, you know, sometimes we need help, you know. And, you know, there was that period where we were told, you can do it all, you can do everything. And you can't, I remember your mother wrote a book, I don't know how many years ago. And she was like, no, you can't actually do everything. You can try, but you can't do it all well. You know, we all need help, whatever that looks like, whatever that means to you, whether it's, like I exercise a lot now because it's, I get to see my girlfriends. I take a bath. It's very important. My boys know not to interrupt me too much while I'm in the bath. they still feel like they can just walk in on me. I think just talking about it, I want to destigmatize the asking for help, no matter who you are, You know, I don't want anyone to feel shamed, whether you have a good job or a great marriage or, you know, you feel privileged or you're not, you know, it hits everyone. And and I think it just goes to show that people who are really struggling and really have nothing really need, there needs to be more services and more conversation, and doctors need to be trained better. They do, you know, they really do. They're much better now than they were in, you know, 2011 or in the 90s, which is when this movie takes place. But, you know, we have a ways to go, but we're doing it. And people like you, you know, who are willing to talk about stuff that's kind of icky. And I really appreciate that. You know, I met you when you were 10 years old and you were asking me questions back then. You don't remember this. You must have been, it was 1999, so I don't know how old you were.
Nine.
You were nine. I was doing a movie with your dad, who I have a lot to thank your dad for a very exciting time in my career. And he introduced me to so many important people that have become, you know, important in my life. And I remember you came to Vancouver, you know, it's like, Arnold's kids are coming. It's like, oh my God, I can't wait to meet. But he never brought you to set. And I remember leaving the hotel one day, you know, with the driver, and you knocked on the window and you were like, where are you going? And I said, oh, I'm going to set. I'm shooting. And you were like, why? And I was like, oh, wow. Well, because it's, you know, we're doing a night shoot. And, you know, I have to spend a lot more time in the hair and makeup trailer than your dad because wigs and makeup and, you know. And you're like, okay. So I feel like we've come full circle. Like you were very, very curious. And here I am thinking like, oh, his kids are going to remind me of him. I'm like, no, you're your mom. You are, you know, you were just adorable, but very curious and you still are. And I think that's, yeah.
Ask a bunch of questions already.
Yeah, ask me a bunch of, like literally knocking on the door and I'm like, who is this little girl? I'm like, oh, wait, that's one of Arnold's kids.
Yeah. Oh my God, I love that.
Yeah, it's really good.
I'm so glad that this has brought us back full circle and that this is...
the circle of life.
I know.
Who knew? Who knew that we would be talking about this, you know?
Who knew? And especially just like, again, you know, such an important topic and such an important subject. And there are so many people that that I know who have experienced postpartum depression. And I think... again, it's so brave of you. It's so admirable of you to be able to be so raw and vulnerable and talk about these things with me, but also just to be able to share them in your Vanity Fair piece and talk about them on a larger level is so helpful for so many people who are experiencing this or who know someone, and gives them the tools to be able to offer help and allow other people to get help as well. So I'm really grateful that you took the time today to talk.
I'm very grateful.
And to write this piece. And I'm gonna post the link to this piece because truly it is, I mean, you wrote it beautifully and really, I felt like I was in the movie of your life while reading it. So I truly, it's a beautiful piece. It's beautifully written. And to wrap it up at the end with your desire to just help other women and help other people in their journey, and also, you know, take away the stigma that comes with all of this and the journey of motherhood and just mental health and maternal mental health. I think it's such an important subject to be talking about, to, you know, have more awareness around and to give moms the help that they need and not have shame when they need to ask for help. So thank you so, so much.
Thank you. You're amazing. And I really appreciate it. And this has been fun. And my first Instagram live.
I know. Congratulations. You did it.
I can stop sweating now. Thank you. So what do we do now?
I'm going to exit out, but I will, but thank you again for everything. And we're going to do a full recap of this on my newsletter, just to offer also tools and resources and a link to your piece, but also your movie, because I think that's going to be really helpful. And again, the whole goal here, which is your goal too, is to create a community of help and support for women and you know, people who will be able to provide tools and resources for people who are going through something similar. So thank you again, Sarah, so much.
Thank you.